Hello.
Hi there,
Hello.
Tamara. This is Bora.
Hi, Bora. So we have I've kind of missed people. So we got Bora and Scott
Done.
and Don. Barbara Mann.
Caroline.
Barbara Mann.
Sunny Lane.
Dave Jones is here.
Hi, Dave.
Hey, been a while.
Hi, Tamara. Hi, everybody.
Candace Leto-Felling's here.
Hi,
Hello.
Candace.
Hi.
And
We have
Toby.
Dick Lathrop, our speaker, is on the phone.
Yep, I'm here. Good. Well, it's good to have the speaker, right? Absolutely.
Yeah.
And Karen, is Karen on the phone?
Caroline Lewis is here.
Okay, so before we get started with our speaker for today, I wanted to ask if there's any announcements from people. As many of you know or are involved with, the Tri-Agency Climate Change Education meeting is going to occur next week in Washington, D.C. Rather unique. It's a combination of the NOAA, NASA, and NSF-funded projects on climate change education. So a number of us are going. Mark McCaffrey, who is not on the phone now, is coming. I will be going.
Wisconsin,
and Frank Nepol will be there.
Sure that your call will be answered as quickly as possible.
Is anybody else who's on the phone going to be there also?
Barbara Mann is. I'm involved with the NASA.
Yep.
And this is Alan Gould. I'll be there.
Great. Are there any other activities going on that anybody would like to let us know about or like input on? All right, well, if not, we'll get started with our featured talk today by Dick Lathrop from Wisconsin on Wisconsin's changing climate impact and adaptation. The link, I sent out the link to the website which has his slides, and so people can go through the slides as he talks, and then we will also post the audio from this presentation along with the slides later on today. So, Dick, why don't you go ahead and start?
Okay, well, thanks everybody for having me. Everybody got the PDF file up so that they can see what I'm doing. If I just tell you what slide I'm on, hopefully in sequence here we'll keep up with it. But let me know if there's any problem. As you can see from the first slide, the Wisconsin Initiative on Climate Change Impacts, we just produced our first assessment report. It's called Wisconsin's Changing Climate Impacts and Adaptation. Okay, we'll go to the second slide, and what I really want to point out here is that this is a science-based assessment. There are a plethora of people here that have contributed to this. The report itself was written by over 30 authors. The editorial team reviewed all the material. The Science Council, of which I'm a member, as well as the editorial team, looked at all the individual working group reports, and there are 15 working groups, 22 chairs, co-chairs, and over 220 members of those working groups. And those working group reports actually are individual assessments that were summarized in our full assessment. The executive summaries are in the back of the full assessment, and all this material, including all the working groups' full reports, are available on our website. And if you just Google Wiki, WICCI, you should find it. I threw in a few slides to give you some context of what our project is about and the structure. We were formed in the fall of 2007 as an outgrowth of efforts by both the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, which I I've worked for, and as well as the University of Wisconsin-Madison's Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies, recognizing that with climate change coming, that we have a lot of impacts to worry about regardless of the greenhouse gas emission reductions that would be promoted and promulgated, whatever things we do in the future. So the organizational structure that we came up with and launched formally in about February of 2008 is shown here on slide 2 and shows that there's a science council, 22 members representing a diverse array of groups through the state, and underneath them we have all these working groups shown here, and there are 15 working groups. I'll show you a slide in a minute about that. And we also have an operations and outreach unit. The outreach activities, now that the report is done, is taking on an increasingly important role here to disseminate the information. We also have an advisory committee. If you go to the next slide, slide 4, you'll see all the collaborators. It's not to look at anyone in particular, but we are truly a statewide effort. So we've really engaged all kinds of agencies, NGOs, universities, tribal groups, and private sector in this project. Slide 5, the Science Council, again, shows you the diverse representation of our membership. We didn't want this to be a Madison-centric kind of project. We wanted representation from different agencies, both federal and state, as well as the university system throughout the state, not just here in Madison. And so some of these logos demonstrate that. And you can see that our primary mission in the Science Council is to help get working groups up and organized so that they, the experts in the particular working groups, can do the actual impact assessments. Next slide, number 6, working groups themselves. This indicates what I just said, is the diverse array throughout the state. Each working group is a particular topic area or geographic region where the assessment is being done. And their primary objectives were to identify potential risks and vulnerabilities pertinent to that working group, summarize existing information on the impacts, identify data and research needs, and then, really important, recommend adaptation strategies for how we would adapt to climate change. Slide 7 shows that we have 15 working groups that contributed to this first assessment report. In the center of the spoke wheel is the Wisconsin Climate Working Group, or the Climate Working Group. Excuse me. They are foundational, providing information on how Wisconsin's climate is projected to change and how it has changed, so that all the working groups have the same set of information to work from.
Can I ask a question? This is Tamara. Can I ask a question?
Yes.
And this, you have Milwaukee and Green Bay identified as a particular working group, but there are other cities in.
Yeah.
Why is there only two that are urban city focused?
Well, there's actually, these are more place-based, and Milwaukee is our largest urban center. The Green Bay is actually the Green Bay ecosystem itself. It's not the city of Green Bay. It's the Green Bay ecosystem. Our Central Sands is a particularly unique region in central Wisconsin that is very sensitive to groundwater withdrawals. So they've formed a working group. And I should make the point that this is a very bottom-up process. While the Science Council could recognize that we need working groups in, say, something like agriculture or water resources, and we were certainly advocating and beating the drums hard to get working groups formed, but this is not a top-down thing where we force people to get on a working group. If we can find champions, and a lot of people interested in the topic of climate change that's pertinent to that working group, whether it's regional or a topic area, most of them are topic area, like forestry or water resources. Those are statewide assessments. It is a bottom-up process, and we have identified already additional working groups that we want to create and move on in our next number of years, and I'll talk more about that at the end. Okay, so I want to go through the whole report just quickly. And again, this is available online, the full report and all the individual working group assessments. But the first chapter, and probably the one that was foundational to us and the information that we got really at the very beginning or early stages, is how is Wisconsin's climate, has it changed, how has it changed, and what is it projected to change? And if we're on slide 9 now, I'll cut right to the chase. They did a lot of detailed mapping work using the weather observational network throughout the state. And it, while there's long-term data that go back on our major cities, say to the late 1800s, 1870s or 1890s, say, but a very detailed distribution map can be created from about 1950 with weather volunteer station network and that NOAA has recorded. So one of the things that looking at these trends, these are spatial trends on 8x8 kilometer grids, you will see that Wisconsin in the winter, for example, has begun to warm. These are in degree Fahrenheit. The scales are colored. And you can see that from northwest Wisconsin into the central part of the state, there's been a lot more warming over this period of time than, say, other parts of the state. Spring has also experienced some warming, not so much in the summer, although we also produced maps that show the trend in the daily max temperature as well as the daily minimum. And interestingly, the daily minimum has been going up more rapidly than the daily max. In other words, the nights are not getting as cold. In the wintertime, we're not having these sub-zero Fahrenheit degree days, as many of those kind of days. And in the summer, the nights are not as they're not cooling off as much. Slide 10, if you look at some of our precipitation changes over the same historic period, if you do a statewide average, it's about 15% increase. But you can see that there are some very dramatic differences throughout the state. And I'll just point to a couple of them. In the south central part, you see that very dark blue zone that's just northwest of Madison here. And I'm going to talk about some of the impacts in that area. And then there's other areas that have also, along our western border, that have seen some heavy rainfall. And then notice in the north, there's some areas that have actually had decreases in rainfall. And these are only through 2006, and this drought in the north had extended through 2009. Finally, in 2010, it started to reverse itself. But
this is Charlie. Another question is when you have the blue area and that 7-inch change.
Yeah.
What percentage does that, because how does that compare to the 15%? What percentage change is that?
Well, I think our average annual rainfall is somewhere in the 30-plus inch range. I can't give you the exact number, so
okay.
I have to go into the climate report to dig that out. But the map is showing that it's gotten wetter by 7 inches as a trend.
Well, just as a note, when you say something across the state is 15%, but then you give the numbers in inches, then people can't compare.
Right.
Well, it's a 15% increase. So, I mean, the figure is trying to show you that there's a lot of spatial variation. So we've had areas of the state that have gotten a lot wetter, and then we've also had areas in the north that have gotten drier. So if you were to do a spatial analysis, it would tell you that the whole state has increased by 15%. And you're right, it's not just the actual precipitation inches. So it's a little, the map was produced and then I put the red on there to show what the overall conclusion was. But you can find that in our report if you want to look for it.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, and feel free, anybody, to interrupt because you've got the slide right in front. We might as well talk about it right there rather than try to go back and remember it or find it later. So I'm perfectly willing to get the questions right at the moment. Slide 11, I threw this in just to give you a sense that we've downscaled the global climate modeling produced, the results produced by IPCC in their 2007 fourth assessment. There were 14 global climate models that had daily data, so we didn't use the ones that didn't have daily data. And there was no attempt to throw out one model or accept another as being better. We're using all of it, which gives a full probability range that of different climate conditions that you can have. And downscaling the global climate model as it lays over Wisconsin, you can see there's about 2 grid cells that would take in the state. But by using the historic database, they were able to develop a probabilistic mechanism, method for downscaling, so we have an 8x8 kilometer grid set of information, and that's how the map on the far right there shows you how that plays out. So projecting for the state, I'm on slide 12 now. In the winter, the color scale is the same as what you saw before, but you can see where we had maybe three to four degree up in the northwest increase historically. Now we're projecting from late 20th century, to mid 21st century, about a 7.5 to 8.5, say averaging about 8 degree Fahrenheit increase across the state in winter, with more warming projected for the northwest compared to what it was as a trend. Spring and fall are in between, say running around 5.5, 6, 6.5. And then summer has the least projected warming, but it's still projected to increase, say, 5.5 degrees or thereabouts. So we're expecting, using the global climate models to, and then downscaling them for Wisconsin, the projections are, and this is the median projection value. So there, it's a probability distribution. There are some projections that are not as great as these, and then half of them are greater. So this is the median temperature change that we're showing on the maps. If you go to precipitation, it's not as dramatic as far as the total amount, and we show here the amount for winter. It's only a about a 1 or so inch increase in precipitation. But it amounts to about 25%. Of course, winter doesn't get a lot of moisture. It gets snowfall. But the one significant thing is that more of the snow, more of the precipitation is going to occur as a rain, in the sense that we'll have shorter winters, a higher probability of rain than we had in the past, and therefore the snow cover. So any metric that relates to snow, snow depth, snow duration, snowfall itself, is going to be significantly reduced, principally due to these warmer temperatures. If you go to slide 14, there's also an indication that we're going to have larger, more higher frequency of large precipitation events. So use the 2 and 3 inch, the two inch is the blue and the more aqua color, I guess, if you're seeing it like I am, is the 3 inch. So the higher rainstorms are going to be having, no matter what the emission scenario, low, medium, and high, we're going to have a higher frequency of these bigger storms as projected by mid-century. So now we'll go into the impacts, and again, I'm walking you through the full report, and each chapter could be a combination of a number of different working groups if they had, in this case for water resources, if they had information that was relevant to this chapter, then they were pulled from the individual working group assessments and summarized in our full report. So one of the things on slide 16 is that just looking at these long-term trend data for ice duration is definitely declining as a long-term trend, and all the longest days are in the historic record a long time ago in the 1800s, and we're having more and more of the shortest winters up in more recent years. There were a couple in the long time ago, but most of them are occurring now. So decrease in duration of ice cover in lakes is definitely one of the signs of warming. You remember, here's the map that shows the temperature, precipitation patterns for the state, somewhat different map, but using the same kind of data. And looking at our stream flow records for that same period, where the U.S. Geological Survey has long-term gauging stations, you'll see that there's pretty good correspondence here. The up arrows indicating an increasing trend in stream flow in the pink or red arrows, and no change with the gray dots, and then a decrease in stream flow with the black arrow down, and the decreases are showing up in the northern part of the state. So these are the gauging stations, so the watersheds themselves, this map doesn't show the extent of the area that contributes to that, but in general, it fits overall that if you have less precipitation, you can expect, less stream flow. Slide 18 is an interesting case study that we talk about because it was a very large a weather event throughout the Midwest, and the colorations here you can see it's over total precipitation for the first half of June, and you'll notice in this south central part of Wisconsin had already trending through 2006 increased precipitation. You can see these purples in the red area there, some very large amounts of precipitation in this event, and it caused massive flooding. And on the right side, I won't go through the list, but you can see the various implications from the flooding, and one of them was a lot of flooding of our sewage plants and raw sewage overflows, and there was some FEMA costs paid on the flood damages. But the point is that this could happen anywhere, and most communities would not be able to handle these kinds of extreme events. And we're expecting, projected to become more frequent in warming climates. So it's a case study. If this were to happen in your community, what would you do, and what's vulnerable? As an example, some slides that resulting from that period, slide 19, on the upper left, our interstate system got flooded. The rivers overtopped their banks, and the bridge system under these interstates couldn't handle it, so the water flooded the interstate. This is northwest of Madison. It also flooded down on the way to Milwaukee, and it shut down the interstate going into Milwaukee. Well, not only can floods from these major events cause problems, but if you get prolonged precipitation, I should have been a little clearer on the trends, or projected trends anyway, projections, that we're expected to have more precipitation in fall, winter, and spring, with those bigger intense storms increasing in frequency, particularly in spring. Not so much change in total precipitation in summer, but more big events. But if the overall amount of precipitation goes up, and we have areas of the state where groundwater flooding can really be a problem, and that zone just northwest of Madison that I showed you before that had that overall long-term trend of precipitation going up, and then when groundwater tables are getting higher, and then all the rain in 2008, just no place for the water to drain, and we're ending up with a lot of what we call groundwater flooding. The water has no place to go; it just sits there. And so here's a cemetery. We're gonna have to be like New Orleans, start burying people above ground. Well, going to slide 20, this is one that I really like to talk about. In our northern Wisconsin, where we had this long-term drought, and it did only break the back of it here in 2010. If you look at a long-term lake level record, where we have one that goes back a long time in that region, Anvil Lake, you'll see that there's been recurring patterns of higher water levels and lower. So there's recurring droughts going on, and they're probably linked to big processes, oceanic processes and that. But the interesting thing, the droughts seem to be getting lower. Now, we can't confirm by this graph, but, you know, are the lake levels rebounding as high? It's going to be interesting to see if that occurs, and now that the drought seems to have reversed itself here in 2010, but levels are still down. And if you think about the implications of climate change, with warmer temperatures, shorter winters, less ice cover, there's going to be a lot more evapotranspiration. We have longer growing seasons. So the water loss is going to, it's projected to completely overwhelm even slight amount of precipitation that would occur if you were not in a drought cycle. So this evapotranspiration impact could be huge. And if you think of systems that are relatively high in the landscape, I mean, we're not a state like the Rocky Mountains, but, you know, we have local topography. And if a lake or a wetland is relatively high in the landscape where it requires, that system requires direct precipitation or very local groundwater levels to be maintained for inflow or keeping it from draining out, this could be a serious impact in the future as temperatures warm and evapotranspiration goes up. We could see these kinds of high in the landscape systems being really water stressed, and of course all the organisms and plant and animals that live in them.
Richard?
Yeah.
Dave Jones, I have a quick question. Is anybody in Wisconsin measuring the temperatures of the lakes?
Oh yeah, we have a lot of in the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. We have trend lakes. The University of Wisconsin has a North Temperate Lakes long-term ecological research project in the north and the south. We have citizen volunteers that are doing it. So there is temperature records. We don't have that many lakes with records that go way back, but we do have one, Lake Mendota here, has records that go back to the late 1800s. And some of the northern lakes had some records in the mid-1900s. So we're definitely measuring temperature now, and, you know, how far back we can go. There's just a couple lakes probably that go way back, but we're clearly monitoring this and would be positioned to look at it in the future and pick up any trends. And, you know, I could talk more about that. I mean, I've looked at the Mendota record, and it's interesting. I guess I'll just summarize it quickly, is that we're not seeing the water temperature getting significantly warmer than what we had in the past, but we're having more of the warm years. We've lost some of the cooler years. I'm talking about summer temperatures here now, summer surface temperatures. So water temperatures are definitely getting warmer. So if you were to plot a distribution of these temperatures, they're all pushing towards the warmer end of the distribution than what we experienced in the past.
Thank you.
Yeah. Slide 21 just is our chapter about natural habitats and biodiversity and just a number of organisms or habitats that are going to be stressed, and we've looked at it. I also threw in the white-tailed deer down there, which is to be one of the winners. I'll talk about that in a minute. But we had a wildlife group and a plants and natural communities group looking at some of these natural habitats and biodiversity, as well as our forestry group. And you go to the next slide, 22. It kind of summarizes the main message in that Wisconsin has a tension zone that John Curtis identified in the 1950s, where north of it, we have a lot of northern species, plants, trees, wildlife communities, all habitats, and then south of this tension zone, all kinds of southern species. So, for example, in the north, aspen and white pine and white birch, balsam fir would be very common species, and the southern kind of oak and hickory tree species. Well, the projections are the tension zone is going to migrate north as temperatures warm, all fitting with the projections and even the recent trends that we've seen and temperature that I already showed you. And as a result, we're going to be squeezing the northern species out of the state, severely impacting plants and animals and the habitats that they depend on, while southern species and communities, some of them are going to benefit. One of the big impacts is a lot of interest in trout fishing in Wisconsin. And if you look at the scenarios for brook trout, currently the map there kind of shows a modeling of a lot of blue. These are miles of stream of where brook trout is found. And if you do some scenarios on various warming, the modeling shows that as you warm, even modestly, 1.4 degree Fahrenheit, you're losing 44% of the trout stream miles. And then a more moderate increase, 4 degrees Fahrenheit, losing 94%. And if you warm it even more, we're totally lost. And the point is that there's some real big impacts on our fisheries in streams. On the side there, you'll see all cold water, three cold water species would be projected to decline, 16 cool water species, a few warm water species, but most warm water species will increase. Now, this has to be tempered by the fact if we get more rainfall and more stream flow, particularly base flow, it's got to be base flow, that there could be more cooling of the stream to offset some of this. So this would be kind of a worst case without any kind of modification in the hydrologic regime of the streams. But these are, for brook trout, they're kind of small headwater streams, and if you lose the brook trout, it's not like the smallmouth bass can move into them because they're just too small for some of those species. So, to summarize the wildlife responses to climate change, it is an interesting table. I mean, there are winners and losers, and you can look at the characteristics of the winners, short generation times, wide distributions, move easily across the landscape, habitat generalists, not sensitive to human activity, and just the converse is on the possible losers. And examples of the winners, gray squirrel, white-tailed deer, temperatures warm, winters get less severe, the deer would expect to increase. European starling and Canadian geese. And the losers, American marten, that requires snow to be able to survive. Redback salamander, if some of these ephemeral ponds or these habitats dry up. Spruce grouse and loon. So our wildlife group has looked at a number of species, including those that are on the endangered list, and started their assessments on individual species and how they would be impacted by climate change in different parts of the state. Chapter 5, slide 25, we have an agricultural working group. Being an ag state, you think we have to have that. They didn't get going as early as some of the others, so their actual results are a little preliminary, but if you go to slide 26, you can see that in the southern two-thirds of the state, we have a lot of ag and cropland, and it's projected by some other studies that for every 2 degrees Fahrenheit of summer warming, corn and soybean yields could potentially decrease by some amount. And, you know, we have longer growing seasons, so that's going to benefit ag, but in the summer, the temperatures are hotter and could become situations that they're going to be water stressed. It will have its impacts on crop. So even on plant hardiness zones, if you're looking, you go to the store and you want a gardening center and you want to figure out what you can plant here, our plant hardiness zones are definitely changing. And it all reinforces the expected northward movement of the tension zone that I talked about earlier. Slide 28, we had a soil conservation, I think they were called, working group, and soil erosion is a real concern, particularly during these spring runoff events as they're projected to increase in frequency, these large 2 and 3 inch rainstorms or greater. And that's when the soil is bare, and so it's a concern that we're going to have to do more on soil conservation to offset the potential erosion that would occur from constantly having more of these big storms. Coastal resources, they mostly looked at communities. They didn't get into the ecosystems themselves yet, but we're going to expand in that area, although some wetland issues were dealt with in the habitats working group. But water levels of the Great Lakes, we didn't specifically look at the impacts on the Great Lakes themselves, but the recognition is that water levels are going to be highly variable, but they're going expected to decline by, say, around a foot or so by the end of the century. So you have to deal with high and low, but expect a lot of variability. And there's all kinds of issues related to that, particularly shoreline erosion, you get slumping and everything else, and as well as need for dredging a harbor. So our coastal communities working group took a fairly narrow focus because that's, again, being bottom up, that's what the people they had and what they wanted to work on, but we're intending to broaden this as we move forward. Chapter 7, people and their environment. Go to slide 33. We just, for our little presentation we did recently, we came up with this one slide. There is a lot of challenges to public health due to climate change, and we've got issues of vector-borne diseases, ticks and mosquitoes. The waterborne diseases are related more to, we're going to have in Milwaukee combined sanitary sewer overflow challenges. The flooding, you've got the sewage treatment plants not able to withstand that flooding. Either they're close to the river themselves and they flood, or the pipe systems are leaky and the infiltration into them exceeds the capacity to handle all that water, so they have to discharge it into what they call sanitary sewer overflows. We've got increased smog issues from warmer temperatures in the summer, so we're going to have air pollution issues related to that and other allergens and so on. And, of course, the heat wave issue, particularly relevant to our cities, and Milwaukee is very aware of that because they, when it gets hot, interesting seeing the sociological research on this, that people are more disruptive. They're not happy. They're hot, and some of the inner city people, the temperatures are much higher. There's real challenges to try to combat the stress from heat. Next slide, 34. Again, pointing out our infrastructure, roads for the flooding, our communities, particularly those along rivers. And here's a sewage treatment plant that was completely flooded. And from the big storm in 2008, all part of our stormwater working group. They did a lot on just the increased frequency of big storms and how it affects our urban areas in particular. So I want to end with going through was a combination of what we had in our chapters 2 and 8, adaptation, principles, and implementation. I think this is really, I thought it was an interesting analysis of how we're approaching this. And if you look at the IPCC way of describing adaptation, it's adjustment in natural human systems in response to actual or expected climatic stimuli or their effects, which moderates harm or exploits beneficial opportunities. And we've also taken the tack that adaptation means how humans will respond to climate change in a way that will make our natural and human systems more resilient. So in other words, natural systems and humans will make adjustments or they adapt to climate change, but we're also saying we need to respond, we need to adapt to where we indicate these projections are going to go. And it's taken in the context of risk management. It's the framework we feel that needs to discuss adaptation, where risk is really the probability of an impact occurring, whether it's flooding or heat or whatever, times the degree of harm or benefit. But in this case, mostly we're dealing with harm. How is something going to be impacted? So if a flooding is a very low probability of occurring, but it has a tremendous amount of damage associated with it, then that would make it higher risk. So principles for adaptation, our group identified a number of approaches or things that we felt we needed to be aware of, and one is the triage approach, and which actions to implement first. And it's a typical triage. If you've got systems, in this example, brook trout streams that are beyond hope, there's nothing you can do, you just leave them. And if there's some that are not going to, they're fine, they won't be impacted, they don't have to have any impact or any management efforts either. But there may be some trout streams where if you put shading in or worked on the channel to make the channel a little deeper and a little less broad so there'd be less solar radiation to the water surface, that you could maintain cool water temperatures there. Or if you can do more infiltration, try to reduce the runoff, that'll add more base flow. So triage is definitely a big part of how we feel we have to adapt. Adaptive management, basically learn as you go, build flexibility in the management practices. Non-point pollution is an excellent example there. No regrets. Choose strategies that increase resilience and provide benefits across all future climate scenarios. So there's no regret to encouraging water conservation and implementing polluted runoff controls. So no matter what happens in the future, these are good things to do. Some more principles. Precautionary principle. Where vulnerability is high, it is better to be safe than sorry. And some of these serious flood damages. So if we can identify that the floodplains are changing due to our changing precipitation patterns, and we've got communities that are going to be in, instead of in the just outside the 100-year floodplain, if they're now in the 10-year floodplain, there should be a lot of thought given to trying to move those neighborhoods or do altered engineering designs to try to prevent the peak flooding, say in some communities with storm sewer systems. Adapting to variability in a climate change. We're going to expect variability and work within it. And if we could figure out, for example, I mean, we know that some winters, particularly El Nino winters here in the region, tend to be very warm. Ice doesn't freeze until late. La Nina years, where we've been having them the last few years, are much colder, and ice is freezing earlier. You could work with this variability and say, okay, rather than close all our ice festivals here in Madison, just because it takes a year of planning, if we could predict when we're going to have a bad year or a good year, then you could plan for the event. So anyway, understand this variability and work with it. That's what we're trying to suggest here. Place-based considerations. Consider the restrictions and special circumstances of place-based impacts. And an excellent example is the Native Americans. They have cultural resources on their reservations, to one in particular, wild rice and harvesting of walleye, spearing of walleye. That the reservations don't get up and move north as the climate moves with, they don't move with the changing climate. So there are definitely place-based circumstances. And then adaptation. Am I on the line?
You sure?
Okay, the phone just rang. I was wondering what that was about. I guess it wasn't my phone. All right, I'm sorry. I'm almost done. Adaptation complements mitigation.
you know, recognize the place of adaptation, the bigger picture. I mean, if you you get co-benefits if you do things for adaptation and that also benefit mitigation. So innovations in mass transit, for example, reduce the amount of emissions vehicle, so but we also get improved air quality. So, you know, some of these things. And in forestry, there's going to be some other similar things. But finally, a road to implementation, taking action, a number of activities we want to undertake to offset some of the negative impacts that are projected on specific resources, and direct management efforts to locations where the actions provide the greatest benefit, somewhat in the triage approach. Building capacity, just got to create better understanding of climate science impacts and adaptation strategies, along with tools for resource managers and other decision makers. Communicating, I don't have to talk to this group, but I get a sense of all the what people are engaged with, establishing dialogue so that the public, decision makers, community groups, and whatever can really understand the impacts and the benefits of adaptation, as well as filling our gaps. And finally, the last one, moving forward, we're really wanting to make this a communication effort. Our outreach is really important now of taking the findings of what we have, but Wiki itself, I use the analogy, it's like dropping the mailbag off at the train station on a whistle stop. All the outreach people are grabbing the mail and thinking out how to distribute it and get the message out of what we've already done. But those of us that are still want to stay on the science part of the train of Wiki, we want to move forward. We want to get new information, new modeling, new studies. A lot of studies were just started during this project and the information wasn't available. So we're feeling in about 4 to 5 years from now, hopefully we'll still be very engaged and be having even better information about these impacts and the adaptation strategies needed and figure out where we go from there. So I guess that's all I have, and I'd be happy to take questions. Hopefully I didn't go too far over. I think I did, though.
No, you're just fine. Thanks a lot. Does anybody have questions?
I have a question. This is Anna Gold from a series. Who funded the report?
Well, we got a grant. First of all, let me say that a significant amount of funding for the various working groups were garnered by themselves, some through the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources using federal segregated monies. But as far as running Wiki and doing the report itself, got a university grant with some match to it that funded this collaborative effort. We call it the Wisconsin Idea, and these are Baldwin grants that help establish working relationships between the university and state government. And our swan song was to use up literally every dime of that grant that we've maintained our project as far as meetings and individual efforts of the Science Council in particular and the getting our advisory committee going. We pretty much used up all the monies in publishing the report. But so we're looking for new funding support now. I know there's going to be lots of challenges, but you know, we don't want this to be a one-time report that goes on the shelf. As I mentioned, outreach is a big aspect of this, and we have a really dynamic outreach. Margaret Mooney in your group is an active member on, and many others, people that work with public education and people that work with our extension system throughout the counties. So a lot of ideas about moving it forward, but funding for the future is going to be a challenge.
Thank you.
So what level of funding did you guys have to work with?
Well, I think I've seen numbers, something like $3.5 million was what our working groups had through various projects and grants to support some of their work. Remember, there was 15 working groups and over 220 people. So a number of working groups got some grants. Others didn't have much at all. They just had to work with whatever resources they had. And I think the Baldwin grant for supporting Wiki was $120,000 or something like that. I'm not sure in exact numbers. I could get that information if you really want to know, or you could talk to one of our coordinators. But the working groups themselves, I think the number we're using is something in the range of about $3.5 million.
Are you aware of any other initiatives like this going on in any other states?
Well, we've had a lot of people inquiring about what we're doing. We've given presentations to Minnesota and Michigan, and of course California's got its own effort. And I know other states are doing things. I think one thing that we did well, I'm not saying better than some others, but we recognized early on that we had to really engage everybody in this in a collaborative effort and make it Wisconsin-based, Wisconsin-centric. Polar bears dying on ice floes doesn't resonate with some of our people in the outlying areas of Wisconsin, but if you can show them that their sense of place is changing, that their forests are changing, and so on, and their winter recreation. We're a state that thrives on winter recreation, and that's changing. This resonates. So our effort really was focused on making it relevant for Wisconsin, but I think the model of how we did it, others are looking at it, and we're happy that they think they might have something here. We have something here that they could use or copy.
That's a terrific job.
Very excellent.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions? Well, this is Tamara. I was going to ask the same question Dave did about other states also. It's a very interesting model to see if it can be coordinated. So if other states also have reports, it would be interesting to look across them to see what you might learn from theirs and they might learn from yours.
Well, let me just add that we are having discussions with broader in a broader region here. We're engaged in some projects that are multi-state. That we one of our leaders in the DNR has gone down to Washington, has been meeting with some of the NOAA and the Fish and Wildlife Service folks about climate change and what we've done and taking that example there. So we are definitely engaged in, becoming more involved in regional efforts and even, like I say, this national assessment if that comes to fruition. So we're very much interested in participating, and we'd be happy to any opportunities that might come forward to be involved. So there are people in our project that are looking for these linkages and opportunities, and some of them have already come to fruition. I know I gave a talk to EPA a year and a half ago, and some dialogue that came out of that went to Michigan, and so I think these regional opportunities for, say, particularly, our management problems in northern Wisconsin are real similar to northern Minnesota and a lot of the state of Michigan. So, and even areas in, farther east. So, there's a lot of benefits to partnering up.
Yeah. So also, if you can take advantage of this presentation also, as we will post the recording of this, so your slides and your discussion will be available to anybody who you might want to send to it, as well as anybody from the Climate Literacy Network who is interested in listening to it later.
Yeah, well, I appreciate that. Well, as Margaret knows, our outreach group is always looking for ways of disseminating our stuff. So if we've got an overview of the whole project that has the slides and the audio talk of me giving it, there's probably ways of that we'll use that ourselves.
Also, if you're disseminating it as a PDF, we could also put the link along with your talk here also on the site, so everything is available together, at least in this venue.
Yeah. We'll be posting I'll probably post on our website our talk as a PowerPoint, too, so we try to keep all our resources available so that if people need information or particular slides or something, I know other people on our project have been cherry-picking talks that I and others have been giving on kind of the overview of the project. So we're having an outreach committee meeting very soon, and I'm sure we'll be discussing where this all goes, because we just unveiled the whole report. We just released it on the 8th or 7th of February. So we want to get the mail and distribute it now.
Okay, well, great. Well, thank you very much. This is very, very interesting.
Well, thank you,
Richard.
Thanks for inviting me.
Very good. Thank you.
Can I ask Richard one other question?
Sure.
Richard, sorry, this is Dave Jones again. I just had a question about the data sets that you showed in your PowerPoint. Are they available at all in, like, shapefile format or KMLs or anything like that we can get a hold of?
Talking about the climate data?
Yeah, the localized, you know, higher resolution maps for Wisconsin.
It's all publicly available. If you contact our climate working group and on our website, you'll know who those people are. The Climate Working Group have made these data sets all available. They're housed at the Center for Climatic Research here at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and all our working groups are using them, and others have asked for parts of them. So the data, that's what we wanted, is have these data, these downscale data readily available. And the Climate Working Group data, I should say, the way they've approached this has become more and more interest around the country. They've already expanded the region of the country tremendously in scope, where they're going to produce the same kind of data beyond just Wisconsin. And Dan Vimont, V-I-M-O-N-T, would be the lead contact there. You'll find him on our website as a link. Or through a University of Wisconsin search, you'll find him. He's at the Center for Climatic Research. He was one of the co-leaders of the Climate Working Group. He can really help you. And we have a lot of derived data that, you know, like snow cover, and they're working more and more on some of these derived measurements that you get from the primary data, too. So the data set is meant to be used, so you can request it.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks a lot, everybody. We will talk again next week.
Okay, thank you for everybody listening.
Very good.
Thank you.